Trump repeatedly downplayed the threat in public for weeks afterwards. Now, as Ben Tracy reports, he's giving a thumbs down to new internal warnings about efforts to fight the virus.
We're not supposed to stand on street corners protesting.
The number of coronavirus deaths is still expected to spike in the coming days. Like Dr. Anthony Fauci, he says if Americans stick with social distancing, the most dire models may not come true.
We can make that number go down. I don't accept every day that we're going to have 120,000 deaths.
The first time I ever did any drug at all is I injected LSD. And boy, I liked it, you know? I mean, it was, you know, looking for God and that whole thing, you know? I mean, I really became a seeker of truth and all of that. And then, you know, the pills thing, you know, came about just from the workload. And the heroin thing came about because I just liked it. I mean, if you've never done heroin, it's great. I mean, it is fucking, it's a vacation for the mind, you know? And I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, we got closure, which is a beautiful thing in life. When you look at this journey and really, it's trippy. Like, my whole set is kind of like trippy now. My hour is like trippy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it
scares black people.
Black people be scared of that LSD talk.
Oh, they did. They are,
because it's not acid is not anything like that's heavy in our community.
No,
yet.
Right.
But I'm gonna get it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you do it a lot.
I've done it enough to really get the message.
Where'd you get hip to it?
Ari Shaffir.
Oh yeah.
Shroom Fest 2014.
That was it.
And Joshua Tree.
Uh huh.
And I did, and I met the creator, and I got to understand it. I had a human experience.
On mushrooms first.
Mushrooms, yeah. Not a black experience. Uh-huh. I explain to people when the weight of being blackness was gone.
Mm.
That heavy weightness that we carry, the trauma that we carry around from slavery, that ended.
Mm.
And I had a human experience and found out actually what it is to be human, which was like the good and the bad, the destruction that we have caused on this planet. That all of us are responsible for, as well as the beauty, like everything we got, computers, airplanes, we created from this planet.
Yeah.
So, and then I had a spiritual experience after that. So I just kept moving up in level.
Yeah.
I'm a little more scatterbrained today. I just did an interview with a friend of mine it's probably going to be an episode.
Huh?
An old friend of mine from the 90s who was an ex-ketamine addict and a big, huge promoter in the psytrance scene in New York back in the day.
Huh. Yeah. I thought only people who did the only drug for psytrance was speed.
Really?
Yeah.
No, psytrance is LSD.
Huh.
But it's speed now?
It is. It is now, I guess. Yeah.
Well, maybe they sped it up. It depends on what BPM it's at, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's the beat of a tweaker's heart.
Are you making this up?
The beat of a tweaker's heart. That's the name of my next single, by the way. The beat of a tweaker's heart.
Aww.
Here we are broadcasting at the beat of a tweaker's heart. My name is James Kent. This is Dose Nation. I'm sitting here with Hilla and Ty Miller, who you should know very well by now if you've been listening to these episodes. And for this episode, I wanted to take a chance and talk about some of the things that we've been going over in the previous episodes, having to do with mental health and therapy and finding a guide or a shaman to help you lead you through what could be a traumatic experience. And Hilla, you have some experience in this. Okay.
A lot happened down here, man.
So Hilla, you have a background in therapy. You're training to be a psychologist. You're in a graduate degree right now.
I'm a therapist in training.
You're a therapist in training. So I wanted to address some of these. I wanted to address some of these concerns with you, since you've said that you've previously done speaking on harm reduction and what to look for when finding a therapist or a guide.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I talk about screening. Both screening yourself and screening a practitioner. So knowing, kind of going into it, like, why am I doing this? Who am I? why am I trying to find someone to help me take drugs right now? You know, what's motivation?
Right. Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit, because it's interesting that people seek psychedelic therapy mm-hmm. in particular.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it seems like the clinical model is you go into a therapist's office and you say, oh, there's something wrong with me that I need fixed.
Mm.
And then they offer you a variety of solutions. One of them may be psychedelic therapy. Why is it that a client
mm-hmm.
would go to a therapist and say, I think I need psychedelic therapy mm. because X?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, probably, at least in, you know, the time of Poland's book, a lot of folks are approaching therapists thinking that they need psychedelic therapy because they've heard about phases or they've heard about trials and research going on with MAPS or something like this, and hearing MDMA helped somebody with their PTSD, and I have that, and it's been making me crazy for 25 years, and then I heard that, you know, I can do this run of therapy and maybe it'll look like this MAPS trial, and I want to feel better because I've tried everything.
So I guess what I'm getting at is there's a word of mouth out there that psychedelics can help you with XXX, PTSD, mm-hmm. depression, mm-hmm. anxiety, mm-hmm. obsessive compulsive, mm-hmm. A variety of different things that go beyond, say, cluster headaches or the other types of things that people would look at psychedelics mm-hmm. for. So if you're a therapist and someone is coming to you with this desire,
mm-hmm.
how do you screen that person to make sure that their mm-hmm. intention is real, or if they just want to see if there's a magic bullet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a tricky thing. A lot of people are, I think, just because of our culture of, you know, take a pill, make it better, mm-hmm. SSRIs and coffee, even alcohol, right? Something to just like state change really quickly. That is sort of our way. But you know, and as a non-therapist answering this question, how would a therapist then screen someone? And usually what I'm talking about is self-selecting,
okay.
just to the public. But, you know, asking yourself, you know, what is it? Why am I doing this? Am I seeking healing? Am I seeking a magic bullet? Am I trying to just make something go away? You know, because it's probably going to be a longer process than that.
Right. So make something go away, like an existing condition, a pre-existing
yeah.
condition.
Yeah.
Or, not like make an issue that's causing you anxiety magically mm-hmm. disappear. It's
yeah.
not going to work.
Well, I mean,
that
I
way.
Think that some folks maybe who haven't had therapy before or are, you know, just unfamiliar with a healing process on a longer time scale might think that it could be like, could you just fix this issue for me? When a lot of times it's like, oh, it's your relationship to the thing, or it's the, you know, the life that you built yourself when you were a different person. Or, you know, like realizing, oh, like, you know, your family is really rough and, you know, it's like taking some time away from that might be helpful, or, you know, there are more solutions.
Wasn't this kind of, it speaks to the whole paradigm that something's broken and it can be fixed, like a car, you know, mm-hmm. like if you get a flat tire, you can replace the tire. But I just don't see it that way. It's a process, as you pointed out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not there isn't anything that's going to fix you because you're not necessarily mm-hmm. broken. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like you can change behaviors or you can change patterns or you can change social networks. But at the end of the day, you know, fundamentally, I think to label someone as broken and needing fixing probably isn't accurate. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you would say to that. But
yeah, yeah. I mean, right. We've kind of talked about before, like our cultural perspective on that, you know, there is a lot of messaging that, you know, we're busted because of our humanity or.
Right. Well, that's a different, that's a different theme where people marketing some sort of philosophical BS try to convince you that the world is broken, right?
Yeah.
The Industrial Revolution, it's capitalism, whatever it is, the system that you live in is broken, right? So that makes you broken because you're just a pawn of the consumer mm-hmm. pyramid. But there's this other thing where individually people can internalize the fact that they are broken somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the letters that I get from people mm-hmm. who have suffered psychedelic trauma, mm-hmm. they will, in real words, say, I feel like I broke
yeah.
something that
yeah.
needs fixing. And that may be a different kind of trauma than the kind of trauma that people mm-hmm. go to get psychedelic therapy for.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really stuck in my mind is I saw a presentation, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
where somebody was saying, we need to be careful that this doesn't become some kind of a spa treatment where people are looking for cosmetic psychopharmacology, where there's nothing really wrong with them in their lives, except that they might be bored or have ennui or have a little bit of spiritual drift. And they think, oh, all I need to do is go into the therapy office or the spa and get a psychic tune-up, and I will come out a better person.
Sure. I think a lot of people do use it that way. I think a lot of people go to ayahuasca ceremonies every month.
And so the idea, so my thought to that was, well, one, what's wrong with that particular paradigm? It's just, I would not put that in a therapy paradigm. Maybe it is a therapy paradigm. It's more like a massage therapy, though, because it's just like a tune-up. I mean, you go in and you get like a quick, like an oil change. Mm-hmm. It's not, you're not like looking at any long-term problems. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh, we're gonna cut your hair and put you in a new suit and get you back out on the street and you're gonna feel great.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a therapy paradigm to me. It seems like that spa sounds about right. Or even just, you know, from a sort of cognitive liberty perspective, like if you want to live your life like that, if you desire to just go in every once in a while and, you know, go talk to ayahuasca or go get super high and whatever it is, then I guess, you know, that's what you want to do.
Well, look at it this way, though. How many people got their ideas to do this from Michael Pollan? You know what I mean?
Well, like, it's so many. Every you know, every time there's some news out there, a new person is going to get the idea to do it. I don't know how widely Michael Pollan's book got out there, but I know he did a lot of media and did a lot of press, and a lot of people heard about it from him and then went to, say, Joe Rogan or somewhere else where they were looking for follow-up information. But in my experience, it seems to be like there's, like all marketing, there's a certain number of exposures that you have to an idea before you say, oh, maybe I should try that for me because X. Well, and sometimes X maybe just because everybody else is doing it.
Yeah. How many people, though, have you met? Like, I know I could probably name a half dozen people in my life that I count as friends that if it's kind of a new agey alternative thing, they'll try it. You know, I could label myself.
In that group, you know, I'll give it a shot. Have, do you have one of those vagina candles?
Oh, no.
No, I do not. I do not.
Not yet.
But we
not
want
yet.
One.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, what did you say? You heard that Gwyneth Paltrow got the idea from...
So I just read it. It was clickbait. So admittedly, I didn't spend a whole lot of time following up on the story, but I did see on the internet that Gwyneth Paltrow got the idea for her candles that were apparently smell like her vagina while on mushrooms.
Yeah. Which was where all good ideas come from.
Absolutely.
I just am really surprised by that.
And as far as I could tell,
the candle, or that the idea came from mushrooms.
That it's an idea at all.
Yeah.
Well, the bottom line is it's more like a potpourri smelling. I think they listed cloves and other thing. I mean, if it smells like her vagina, if that's what her vagina really smells like.
Well, we can assume that she has a custom douche vagina wash combination that she does 2 or 3 times a day. So her vagina probably does smell like potpourri.
So I'll go on the record and say I would be willing to find out if we can do somehow work this
can we
out.
Get her on the show and I'd ask say her we more can. About this.
Enough. But anyways, the whole point being is why is Gwyneth Paltrow, I believe the show that she's on called The Goop, why is she having her kind of I don't know even how you would describe it, but it's like essentially this CEO type culture or this entrepreneur type culture of people that are trying to explore. And in their cases, you know, somebody had some trauma, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, let's go to, you know, Jamaica or wherever they went. And they went to a place where they could work with mushrooms, and then they worked with the mushrooms. And it's just like, what is driving this narrative in this culture? What is driving it? How did it get from freaks, you know, to literally you're talking about the ultimates,
the elites.
The elites is really what it comes down to. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, How did we get here?
Well, you asked about the candle.
let me circle back.
No, we can continue this conversation more. I wanted to get back to the therapy paradigm with Hella.
So hold on, because I want to go back to the very top of this, because I've always wondered about even this label, harm reduction, because implicit in the label of harm reduction, right? Oh, is that on the list?
That's the first thing I have is harm is the first word in harm reduction.
Okay.
Which is one of the only places in the psychedelic community where there is a tacit acknowledgement that psychedelics are potentially harmful. That's the only place.
Okay. And there's a lot of discussion about that, that folks don't want to use that term.
Right.
I see it sometimes because it's like in the forefront of my mind as a term.
Sure.
A lot of times, like, the, you know, that if I'm going to title something, I'll say risk reduction. You're taking a risk. We don't know that the harm is going to happen.
I call it death avoidance.
Death avoidance.
I'm still
good. That's good.
I'm still taking qualms with the second word, though, because it's suggesting that every time that you're doing it, you know, harm reduction, it's saying that you're going to be harmed in some way and that you have to reduce the harm.
Well, I think it's that there are harms that can happen.
By saying harm reduction, you're saying that you're going to be harmed a certain amount and you want to reduce it.
This is an interesting idea that I wanted to explore a little bit, because there's a whole lot of things around the psychedelic experience, like training, mindset, intention, you know, doing your homework, a lot of preparation, so that when you walk over the coals, you don't fall down and burn to death. And then when you get on the other side, there's all of these things like integration techniques or support groups or talk therapy or some sort of artistic therapy that you need to go through to sort of burn the experience out of you. And my question is, you don't really need integration techniques or support groups or a lot of preparation for something that's just an innocuous experience. You need all of that stuff for something that is a dangerous experience, right? Like walking a tightrope or walking over hot coals. It seems to me that there is an implicit acknowledgement here that this is a dangerous thing. So that if you want to go do this dangerous thing, here's how you do it safely or safe-ish. And I hear people say, oh, well, skiing is very harmful. And it is. A lot of people die skiing and they mess up their hips and ankles and legs. And they need a lot of training and sometimes they need a lot of therapy afterwards.
Different kind of therapy, though. Yeah.
But skiing is fun.
Yeah.
Skiing is fun. And sometimes for when you're good at it, when you go skiing, it's a good workout. So it's also therapeutic. But it is also dangerous. So there's this question here in the whole harm reduction paradigm. The first rule of medicine is do no harm. Right. So if you're giving somebody a substance that may have an implicit danger, is there a paradox there? Is there an ethical paradox there? And should you warn the patient about that up front? I mean, people don't get warned about that up front nearly enough, I think. Although if you go into, you know, a clinical trial, you're going to have to sign a bunch of waivers that say X can happen and we're not responsible.
Well, especially in the scene too, you know, in the scene where, you know what I'm talking about? The scene, you know,
Mama Ayahuasca. I used to hang out in the scene.
Yeah. I think all three of us may have at one point. But the whole point being like...
I dabble.
You know, what's the old saying that... There are no bad trips, you know, or whatever, you know, however you want to look at it. It's like, it's interesting because I would really like to see, which is kind of speaks to both of your guys' points. I would really like to see this idea in any sort of therapeutic setting stated that like, this could potentially be dangerous. Whereas in the scene, it's never presented as being dangerous, you know, like, although there's a very real possibility that you could end up naked, you know, literally naked with none of your possessions.
Or you could end up on the floor passed out. Or you could be seizuring somewhere. I mean, that very rarely happens, but it does.
I think, you know, I think that in certainly there in clinical trials, and if you go to see a practitioner with an education and training, that they're going to inform you of the risks.
I mean, you'd have to, right?
Yeah. And, you know, you sign a
but in terms of like
form
a
and
somebody who's leading. Ty sent me a Facebook ad for somebody who was leading a local ayahuasca circle.
Yeah. So I wouldn't expect to get really very much information at all from that situation.
Right. From that so fella. What I'm saying is there's a lot of low level exposure mm-hmm. places where somebody passing themselves off as a shaman or a guide or a leader brings people into this circle or the ceremony under the pretenses that this is a sacred healing thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And yeah. So what do people who are thinking about that experience, what do you, when you go to meet this person who's leading the circle, what do you ask them? What, I yeah. mean, do you, yeah. it's not about how many sessions you've led. What do they need to tell you to be reassuring for you?
Yeah.
Specifically for you, I'm
for
asking.
Me? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, so I want to know, you know, so say I'm going to go to some, you know, person I've never met before and I'm going to trust them in order to give me ayahuasca that is in fact what they say it is, containing plants that I think that I know what go into ayahuasca, right? Which already, you know, everybody says, oh, it's just the two plants. It's just the two plants. Everyone says it's just the two plants, right? It's mm-hmm. just, the, you know, the MAOI mm-hmm. and the DMT containing plant. But, you know, then I hear a lot of stories of like, oh, I'm not sure. I think there was something crazy in there. Or I think that there was toe in it is a lot of times.
Datura, toe, the belladonna, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. sometimes tobacco. Sometimes there's high levels of nicotine in
there. Sure, which is like, okay.
It's more of a South American thing.
Well, it's more of a purgative. They add the nicotine for a purgative.
Yes. Yeah, sure. Which is so much more chill than going completely, you know, out of your mind, not expecting that you've just consumed Toei or Brugmansia datura, and spinning out. So first of all, I want to know, what is it that I'm consuming at this ceremony and mm-hmm. that, you know, I can trust this person to give me what they say. So there's actually no way, unless you happen to bring a calibrated HPLC along with you to find out like what is in this ayahuasca, you're not going to know. So there's that.
Can't tell just by smelling it?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
or tasting it. Like, oh, this tastes gross. Okay, it must be ayahuasca.
You may need a few more experience points before you get that skill.
That was a D&D reference.
Oh, I missed it. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, that's all good. That's all good.
Thanks, Todd. So... would you specifically ask them, so what are the risks of me drinking this? And if one of those risks happen, how are you going to handle it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't. Typically in...
Because you know. Because you've done the homework, supposedly.
Yeah, and also, yes, I mean, just, yeah, I hope so. And I think a lot of times in an invitation, often... like, you know, an invitation, you might get an email. Is there a lot of, I can't believe how many just regular old Gmail email lists there are for ayahuasca ceremonies. I'm sure. Like, you guys, Proton Mail, can we get some encryption here? Can we get some encryption? Like, let's just be a little more cool. So, you know, I get a Gmail invitation that doesn't use the word ayahuasca, but it's clear what it is. It's like, you know, ceremonies with grandma or something like this. Mm-hmm. And it'll say grandmother ceremonies. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I know her. And it'll say something like, you know, make sure that you follow this diet. One thing that is not
that's the ever... only warning, though, is follow the diet?
No, there are more.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll go into a little bit. But just something that was coming to mind that I notice in most I guess every place I've looked that the ayahuasca diet or dieta for just drinking the tea on its own doesn't differentiate between what is a physiological harmful contraindication and what is a spiritual contraindication.
Right.
And that I find to be really problematic.
Can you go into that?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
It's like tyramine, right? Or...
yes,
pyramine-containing substances
is,
and other things like that, aged cheese or,
yeah,
you know.
You know, ripe bananas, ripe avocados.
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about?
So there's a chemical tyramine that's usually found in aged foods.
Okay.
But also in ripening foods. Mm. That can cause what, rapid heartbeat?
Headache.
Yeah. High blood pressure. Mm. When you take it in concert with an MAO inhibitor, mm-hmm. one, and the DMT on the will also increase your blood pressure and cause these side effects. So it compounds the side effects, and it makes it potentially deadly because you could go into cardiac arrest or have a super high blood pressure spike.
Potentially, I don't know that anyone has died from that specifically, which And even with, I saw a presentation and looked into a fellow's research, it was a couple of years ago, but even looking into the Santo Daime Church, a church that is a sort of Christian Catholic monotheist, and they use ayahuasca in their ceremonies, their church service. So there, and there is a really large population of Santo Daime members in Brazil. And so there were a lot of Santo Daime members surveyed, and a lot of them take SSRIs. And what they do is they skip the dose the day before and the day of their service, and then they resume their SSRI afterwards.
That's not how they work.
That can't be good for you.
Well, it's the reason that I bring it up is that we don't have good science about what is safe practice around drinking ayahuasca. We just don't. And there's not good information differentiating between what is the spiritual assignment and what is actually safety.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other dietary restrictions? I mean, contraindications other than those?
Eating vegetarian or vegan, you know, not consuming animals or animal products.
I'm talking about specifically pharmacological contraindications, things that are...
Pretty much any other drug at all.
Oh.
Yeah.
But what about foods that are contraindicated? Anything else besides the...
Anything that is good, fermented foods, salty foods, sweet foods, anything processed, really. It's pretty much just eating a basic vegan diet.
You're not supposed to have coffee or chocolate.
Chocolate. Yeah, chocolate's an interesting one. No sex. Yeah.
But these are spiritual contraindications.
Right, but there's no separation with it, right?
I'm just wondering if there's other medically sound food. I mean, you could probably look all this up on the internet, but and I remember I used to be very deep into this because people would say you can't eat this and you can't eat this and you can't eat that, and I would just usually, you know, fast for a day before,
and
do a lot of internal cleansing, drinking a lot of water, mm-hmm. and, you know, purging my system before mm-hmm. I actually
right,
do
which
it.
Is, that's smart. Yeah, it makes it more chill. I mean,
it makes it more chill. My problem is that you get serious low blood sugar spikes, and you can get profound depression and low energy. Yeah. So you sort of need to balance that out by like having an orange or something.
Yeah, and for me too,
you can eat while you're feeling those dips.
Yeah. For me, I have low blood pressure and low blood sugar, just kind of like in general. Mm-hmm. So I faint more than any person I know.
Oh.
And so if I fast and I don't have salt, that's really not good for me.
Yeah.
So there's a long period of time where I'm drinking ayahuasca pretty regularly and just inebriated, cannot move, you know, totally like don't know what my blood pressure is doing, but I bet it's real low. And, you know, like not being able to get up and having to like crawl across the floor in the ceremony and just being, you know, I'm having a great time because I'm high, but I'm also like, what's going on with me right now? And realizing I need to have some snacks. Like I need to have salt. I need that.
Yeah.
Well, I've had that. I've had that happen to me where I had to crawl across when I was trying to pee and I would sit up and I'd be like,
nope,
I'm not going to pee this time. maybe in 20 minutes from now. So, but to be honest with you, I've never adhered to a dieta.
Yeah. I'll just eat like, you know, I'll just eat bland food for a couple of days is usually what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. This is just it though, is I generally eat pretty clean anyways.
Oh yeah.
So it's like for me, eating what I normally eat is probably what most people would not necessarily diet, but you know what
but
I mean?
But you have had chocolate and
I've had chocolate.
Pig's meat before you drank
ayahuasca. And I've had
pig's meat.
A kombucha.
It's called pork. Thank you.
I've had a kombucha before, which is the
fermented. You're not supposed to have the fermented beverages, but so there are a lot of people who say I don't diet at all and mm-hmm. doesn't cause me any problems. I found out for myself that if I go into a session and I have like undigested food in my stomach, even from like 12 hours ago, mm-hmm. I'll just sit there and focus on the fact that my intestines are knotted and
really in touch with digestion at that time.
So that's just it. I've never once purged on ayahuasca, and I've never once had like a real stomach problem, but I'll mm-hmm. have kind of a like literally a light salad a few hours beforehand, just so mm-hmm. that there's something on my stomach, mm-hmm. just to, because I don't want to be hungry. That would be the worst thing of all, you know. Like I'll take take all the panthers and the rides and stuff like this and like the existential crises, but if I'm hungry,
don't
man
be hungry.
Well, I actually was at a Burning Man one year, and I took LSD with some friends early in the evening, like 4 in the evening, and we were walking around the playa all night, back and forth, all night, You know, we must have walked, you know, 5 miles maybe over the course of the night all over. And at one point, my knees just buckled under me.
Oh, wow.
And I fell to the ground and I couldn't get up. And I was like, I can't, my muscles don't work. And everyone was looking at me like, do you need water? And I'm like, no, I have plenty of water.
Electrolytes.
And once, like, when's the last time you ate? And I was like, last night, maybe this morning sometime. And I had just completely depleted myself of calories or potassium or something that was not making my muscles move anymore. And thankfully, somebody had a Clif Bar and they gave it to me and I sat there and ate it. And literally like 3 minutes later, I was like, oh, I'm working again. Everything's working again. I guess that was the problem. I just literally ran out of fuel.
So where can we get that acid out of?
No, was that show? No, that was Nicholas Sand acid that I ate that year. That was some of the acid that he made in Vancouver just shortly before his bust. And I got some of the last. There was the police came into the lab and cleaned everything out except in the freezer under some of the permafrost and the ice. There was a Ziploc bag, an empty Ziploc bag. That had once contained a massive amount of LSD powder.
Right.
So all they did is went in and they washed out the inside of the bag and they got it. And there was probably like 200 hits in there.
Awesome.
Cause it was, and I got some of that, the last gasp of that acid. But it was good. It was very good. Probably the cleanest acid I've ever had. I think Nicholas Sand is probably my favorite. And I've had Alexander Shulgin's acid. Mm-hmm. Very good, very clean. Mm-hmm. Something a little different about Nick Sand's acid. Just a little bit cleaner.
I don't know how it uses turmeric.
paprika. So Nick Sand told me that he goes for the quintessence, or the quadcep, which is when you clean the final crystal 3, 4, or 5 times until you get the perfect purity. And he says you can tell the perfect purity when it's recrystallizing. You can just tell by the way that the crystals are forming that it's done. You know, this is it.
Cool.
This is done.
So just to bring this up real quick, like if you were to go to my house right now and look at my laptop, right?
Yeah.
If you closed all the inappropriate browsers, right, with the questionable material on them, you would see that I actually looked up the word quintessence a few hours ago.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Yeah. And what does it mean?
It's like the paragon is the perfect example of something.
And it's an alchemical term meaning something that has been dissolved and recrystallized 5 times.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In a purification process, so you get to the quintessence.
Oh, so that's the fifth one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. That's what Nick Sand told me. Huh. So if he's wrong, he was bullshitting me.
Or maybe what he says.
I don't remember anything about the 5. I mean, we could look it up. I think we all have access to Google. But
I had never heard that before, so I don't think that's in the common definition.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
I will.
Okay. So just to kind of circle back to the topic, I'm curious what you guys think of this because I've kind of seen this become more and more popular of signing waivers at ceremonies. Did you guys ever sign waivers?
Mm-hmm.
Or you've never sat really in an ayahuasca ceremony, have you?
I've been in a couple like house ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. Did you sign any waivers?
No.
Waivers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've signed waivers.
Yeah.
The first time I think I signed a waiver.
We ate wafers.
Was it the body of Christ?
That was the
Yeah.
They have a gluten-free option because
corn chip tortilla.
Does that count as a miracle if it's gluten-free?
If it tastes good, yeah.
Do you realize that is cannibalism?
What, eating the flesh of Christ?
Yeah, it's cannibalism. It's cannibalistic ritual.
Well, there's a lot in the specifically the Catholic interpretation of Christianity that went very much towards this morbid death cult kind of thing. Jesus does die on the cross and he's dried out like beef jerky and then he's resurrected. I mean, this is a whole morbid side of it.
Yeah.
And the Catholics would collect relics of people, like little bones and little pieces of their ear, and they're on display in these cathedrals in Europe. You can go, oh, here's the toe bone of Saint Joseph, and it's like
why do y'all
really
have the toe?
Oh, they got tons of skulls down in the basements of the cathedrals there. That's just crazy. But there's a sort of a little morbidity there about eating the flesh of Christ. It's sort of, you know, feast on me like crows.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's bizarre. I mean, it's really frankly bizarre.
It wasn't bizarre back then. We just think it's bizarre now. Back then it was cool.
Unless they're really talking about the mushroom.
Yeah, they're talking about the holy mushroom.
No.
That is.
No.
You've cracked it, my friend. Yeah, I think you're onto something. Has anybody written a book about this?
Oh, boy. Please don't.
So I want to, here's a question I have, because this is something that's bothered me ever since the 80s, I guess, maybe the early 90s. Hilla mentioned something earlier when we were talking about psychedelic gurus moving into religion and spirituality as a dodge or to avoid scrutiny from the law. Couldn't you make a similar argument that a therapy community isolated itself in the 70s doing the same thing to create a quasi-legitimate arena where they could do all of this experimentation outside of the scrutiny of the law, because it's not happening at street level, it's happening at this little higher academic level. But really there's the same kind of tomfoolery going on.
So it's basically a cult under the guise of therapy, is that what you're saying?
Well, maybe a cult
or
an affinity group, a psychedelic users group that's now operating under the guise of therapists, and there are, you know, Stan Groff sits at the top of the pyramid, and then everybody else, well, it just, you know, chronologically, you know, from top, from like the old days, there was one, you know, and then there was Myron Stolaroff, there was a couple more, but there's like a few leaders back in the 50s and 60s in psychedelic psychotherapy that, you know, then got shut down during Prohibition. But then this sort of underground movement came in where we're all new age loosey-goosey therapists and we do massage and, you know, all not massage. We do we do hypnosis and we do all sorts of personality retraining and retuning and we're going to put you in the isolation tank. And, you know, there was all of this new kind of experimental stuff going on. And I feel like that there was a big psychedelic or drug undercurrent that was going on in that thing. And that people who are into psychedelics, who get attracted to therapy, see that as one way that they could legitimately do these experiments sort of within the bounds of the law. So my question is, is that a legitimate assumption that some people use therapy as a dodge to, say, you know, get freaky with people without a lot of scrutiny? And how do you separate out that kind of a person from a legitimate therapist who is actually going to, you know, not try to take advantage of you, not try to make an overly familiar connection with you, not try to mind game you or whammy you with their own specific form of therapy, but are actually going to take your particular needs seriously and, you know, treat you with a proper therapist-patient relationship.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is this person actually a therapist?
Oh, well, there are a lot of
licensed trained therapists. Well, let's start, you know, starting there.
Okay.
Right.
So assume that they are. Assume that they've all been trained and they've gone in therapy and that they're in therapy with somebody else who maybe is also a psychedelic therapist. So,
right. Yeah. How to determine if they're not sketchy or if they are sketchy.
Right.
Even if
they're
a trained person.
What are the clues to tell if they're sketchy or not? I mean, because honestly, the people who will go down the road of doing psychedelic therapy with you are already in a kind of a risky situation, right? You know, they're already hanging themselves out there a little bit because it's not within the bounds of legality, but it still does happen.
So
are all of those people sketchy? I mean,
there are different levels of sketchiness. Like, are you operating the underground? Are you doing something illegal? Do you have a mostly cash life? Like, yeah, that's sketchy. But it's also like,
so if they want to get paid in cash.
Well, I'm not saying it's bad either. Yeah. Like, you know, I kind of like sketchy. Like, I'm into psychedelic drugs, you know.
Well,
like, I talk a lot about how I don't like capitalism. So
can we not talk about that?
Sorry.
Nothing wrong with capitalism.
For 10 minutes.
It's just the people running the system. You know, can't be trusted. Too corrupt.
I just figured we could talk about psychedelic drugs, but if we start talking about capitalism, we're going to get some heat on us.
Well, sure. We can. Well, actually, we can. We might be able to get into it a little bit later because I have some.
So,
I have some other topics that I wanted to talk about when we get through this.
Hold on, I want to just interject real quickly because when we start talking about psychedelic psychotherapy, right, and levels of sketchiness and stuff like this. And I'm actually more on your side, Hila. I would prefer to go to someone that has beads in a Himalayan salt lamp and this type of thing. I would feel more comfortable there.
Wait, did I say something about that?
No, you said that you were sketchy. Comfortable with a little bit of sketchiness.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is, I think, many people in the psychedelic community are.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about first exposure people who like go looking for a therapist to seriously treat them.
Yeah.
So they don't want a gonzo experience necessarily.
So hold on. This is the point that I'm trying to make, though. Mm-hmm. This is the point that I'm trying to make is why aren't those people seeking out a normal therapist first? Does this make sense to everyone?
Yeah.
Like a legit therapist first. And then, because it's like, it seems to me like everybody I know is just like, oh, psychedelic psychotherapy is perfect for me. And it's like, are you sure?
Have you tried other therapy?
So this is a good point.
Yeah.
People should maybe get a psych eval and a little bit of therapy under their belt first with a non-psychedelic therapist before actually jumping into the deep end with somebody who may want to like probe around in your brain.
There is an assumption that I'm hearing in what you're saying too, which is that a therapist who is practicing psychedelic psychotherapy is just going to jump right into drugs.
Oh, sure.
So even if it's a person who is practicing sober psychotherapy and psychedelic psychotherapy, no legitimate trained psychotherapist who's trained in psychology and trained in using drugs is going to just throw drugs at someone without actually like getting to know them and sort of having a therapeutic relationship established first.
So this is a good point. If you walk into the office and say, I'd like you to prescribe me mushrooms, and they say, sure, let's do it, that's maybe a bad sign.
That's a bad sign.
If they say, well, let's take some time to evaluate where you are in your life and what you want to achieve, and then after a month or two, if you still want to do this, then we can do it. Or maybe, I don't know what the waiting period is.
Right, but like after we've gotten to know each other a bit. Or
20 minutes, say.
Sure, 20 minutes. Yeah, quick little what's up.
But like maybe two or three sessions at least to get a feel for somebody and whether or not how they would respond to the experience.
Probably at least, And I think that, you know, like entering into that relationship with a person who you consider to be a professional, it should be really clear that this person is screening you and getting to know you and like wants to make sure that you're safe and wants to make sure that there aren't any contraindications, and they want to know about what else you've tried and what worked and didn't work.
Right. And if it feels like they're grooming you or running you through some games or any kind of intimate probative things that cross the line, maybe that would
be anything line crossy should definitely be a red flag. And knowing, I think one also really important thing that I like to encourage people to ask is, what's your accountability system? Do you have teachers? Do you have mentors? Are you in community? What do I do if I don't trust you? Who do I talk to?
All right, if I have a complaint, how do I address that?
Yeah, what do I do?
So are we going to, I mean, seriously, are we going to sit here as three kind of
hacks?
Amateurs? Or not amateurs, but what's the word? Maybe hack is a better word. But like if someone came to you, you know, and you're not, but if you were like a psychedelic therapist, or if I was a psychedelic therapist and somebody came to me and was like, look, I just want to trip balls.
Yeah.
Right?
Right on.
That's almost better in my mind than someone that's like, well, I have these traumas that I'm going to resolve with the psychedelic experience.
Well, they're different people, I think.
They're
some people do want to trip balls. Like, I like to trip balls. But, you know, I also like healing, too. So I think it's like, you know, if you're going to a therapist and it's clear that you want to trip balls, the therapist is probably going to say, you know, maybe investigate finding these drugs somewhere else.
Well, that's the funny thing, though, is because then you're all of a sudden thrown to the mercy of the party culture, where it's like, and this is just shit that I'm just coming up with right now on the spot.
Are those our only options, therapy or party?
Those are the most, party culture, the scene, is the easiest way to get access.
Well, let's face facts, too. The ayahuasca culture now is the party scene.
I think that
scene,
might be
it?
More easy to access for a lot of people.
I think they're different scenes.
Well, it just costs more.
No, well, see, there is a party scene that is, you know, raves, festivals, bands, and stuff like that.
Talking to people.
Or house parties. Even just house parties is still a scene where, you know, people are just tripping balls on whatever. And it's not an ayahuasca circle, and there is no sacred space, and there is nobody beating the medicine drum. Everyone is just sort of like, like, ooh, the cuddle pile over here. And oh, somebody's making smoothies in the kitchen. Whoa, nice. These are crazy.
So James is having a party
later on this week. He's got a super nice raw food bar with all of the Vitamix and
exactly.
Goji Himalayan berries. Salt lamps.
We got the vagina candles are over here in the corner.
They're burning. You know, I don't think it's as easy to find. A lot of people I talk to, it doesn't sound, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to, you know, like find what I'm looking for and, you know, or make some kind of comment like this. But to me, it sounds very obvious. Go to a party. Go to a party. That's where drugs are. You know, drugs are at parties.
You have to get invited to
the party. So not necessarily. I mean, there are flyers all over phone poles. You know, it's like they look campy and have neon colors. Like there will be drugs there. But a lot of folks are just not comfortable with that. It surprises me because I like parties. You know,
I wouldn't.
It sounds like you guys like parties.
I wouldn't go to a party. I'm kind of antisocial in that way. Like I would just be too probably. It just wouldn't even occur to me, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I went to a lot of parties back in the day and would find myself sitting in the corner going, why am I not enjoying this?
And why weren't you enjoying it?
I just don't think I'm a party person. Mm. It gets too overwhelming for me. If there's like four or five people and everybody's like talking and grooving and getting into it, that's a little bit easier for me. But if there's like just a bunch of people and there's like multiple conversations going on, I just get so... I mean, it's like I have this problem where I hear everybody in the room.
Yeah, me too.
So I can't just focus on one conversation. Yeah, I'm hearing every conversation. Yeah.
And every time I'm at a party too, I'm just thinking to myself, this is taking away time from writing my manifesto.
And once it's done, you people will understand.
you will know.
We'll know.
I've got to tell you.
So, yeah, I wanted to, you know, we mentioned this a couple times before, but we're not therapists. We could get some things wrong. In fact, if you've listened if you've listened to these episodes, you know that we get things wrong. We forget names. We talk about stuff that we're like, oh, I read about this once.
We make things up.
Right. Sometimes we make things up. Sometimes
we channel things from Metatron.
We repeat BS that other people tell us. So, you know, sometimes it's frustrating when you're out here and you know more than us. And you go, oh, you fools, you didn't mention this or you got this wrong. Mm-hmm. Feel free to write in and tell us when we're wrong. And also feel free to look for other sources of information on this because, you know, we're not the authority. I have some experience in this field. Hilla has some experience in the therapy community. Ty has some experience unraveling his own demons. Right. Using psychedelics to work through his own... his own process, whatever, whether it's just tripping balls or
just skinny dip in the lake.
And he's not insane yet.
That's right.
So, like, clinically.
So I would just like to point out, too, if any of those listeners would write in and let James know when he mispronounces something.
That'd be great.
Yeah, we're here to forget names and mispronounce things. That's what we do.
I had a note here about something that we were talking about earlier. That now I'm not totally sure, but we're talking, it was about around the risk reduction piece. And like, I was kind of hearing like a couple of things get blended in that I think a lot of people talk about because of research and because of hearing about, you know, how amazing it was, for my end of life anxiety in the psilocybin trial at Johns Hopkins, right? So having like these expectations and then the expectations come from information for a very specific protocol, right? So sort of like mixing in the risk reduction or harm reduction piece and maximizing a benefit, and that the protocol and this information kind of tells us like a very specific way, you know, how is it that someone's end of life anxiety was resolved with psilocybin, and like to be careful of not mixing those things up because the risk reduction and benefit maximization is coming from a really specific protocol. Does this make sense?
It makes sense, but it's still, I mean, it's just still an odd play on words. You know, I prefer you call it? Benefit maximization?
Mm-hmm. Benefit maximization?
I would go with benefit maximization every day over risk reduction.
Well, harm reduction, I think, came out of the party culture in the 90s when there were all of these bad pills. Mm-hmm. There was a couple big busts in the 90s where MDMA kind of got hard to find. So people were substituting pills that were caffeine and ketamine and whatever, DXM or... DMX? No, DMX is the Rough Rider. DXM.
Is that the barking?
Dextromethorphan,
no,
yeah.
Guy. Sorry.
I think he's a rapper.
Rapper, yep, DMX. Yep. Yeah, he does bark.
Okay, I think yes, he does. I remember. Yeah.
He's had his own troubles. But but so there were a lot of testing kits. Mm-hmm. People started producing testing kits.
Dan Safe is still at the party.
This was the beginning of the harm reduction movement, and it didn't have to do with...
In the psychedelic world.
Yeah. Yes. It wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is the proper way to safely take your drugs. It was, let's identify what drug you're taking first.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, I get a lot of emails from people who say, I took a pill or I took something that I thought was LSD, but then this thing happened to me. And now I'm pretty sure I didn't take what I thought I took.
Right.
And maybe I took way too much of it. Mm-hmm. What do I do now? And it's like, well, shoot, if you can't identify what it was, I mean, we can just kind of go backwards and guess what you may have had. But that becomes a big problem when people have a lingering psychosis and like some sort of intense guilt and shame wrapped around the fact that they overdosed themselves. Mm. And then they realize, I'm not even sure what it was that I took. Mm-hmm. It becomes like this triple whammy that's really hard to recover from. And I think maybe, you know, always, like you said, ask what's in your ayahuasca. But you always got to ask, I mean, unless you're just taking mushrooms and you can identify mushrooms by species, there is a little bit of a risk unless you've made it yourself or unless you know the person who's made it.
Or if you've tested it yourself. Right, ecstasy data is still testing drugs.
That's
you can
great.
Still send them drugs.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love going and looking at all the pictures of the pills.
Me too.
There's something really fascinating about that. It's like, this is anthropology.
Yeah. It's like, ooh, pink dolphins. That's fun.
It's research.
Yeah,
I've never looked at the website, but I've only ever taken.
Oh yeah, they find fentanyl and stuff. They find every kind of pill. I mean, it could be like, you know, it's not MDMA, it's 2CB and fentanyl. What the hell? Yeah.
Yeah, I've only taken pills maybe a handful of times. It's just not appealing to me.
Yeah.
And you prefer mushrooms or?
Mushrooms or maybe a little acid or ayahuasca. I'm usually down for.
Yeah.
But I'm not a frequent imbiber even of those. It's just, but I'm not in the party culture, so it's not. I'm just not around those things. Like, and I don't seek it out. You know, like I don't seek out cocaine either. You know, I can't even remember the last time I saw cocaine.
I remember the last time.
It's a little dreamy over there.
I could tell you about the time I smoked crack, but that's a different story.
I tried to smoke.
I would like to hear it.
Yeah. I tried to smoke crack one time, but I think it was all gone.
I'll tell you the short story. I think I could probably do it in 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was traveling in a foreign city. I'm not going to say where.
Linwood?
Yes, it was Linwood. That's a Western Washington joke for all you people who are listening around the world. Linwood is an uptight Bandroot community not too far from
more
here.
More of a... methamphetamine, but
yeah, you definitely find
still
that
still funny.
So I was in my hotel and I didn't have weed and I was having trouble sleeping because I was traveling. I didn't have any weed with me and I hadn't smoked in a couple days and I was just like, I can't sleep. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I know that there is the sketchy part of town just like 5 or 6 blocks from my hotel that way, so if I wander over there, I'll probably find somebody that I can score from. So I went down to this notorious part of town looking for someone selling weed. And there were some Hispanic people on the corner. I'm guessing they were Guatemalan just from the way they were talking. And one of them, I said, yeah, I'm looking for some weed. You guys have weed? You know, they called me over when they saw me. Immediately they knew that I was I was looking.
You're looking for them.
Yeah, I was looking for them. And he said, oh, you want smoke? You want smoke? And I was like, yes, yes, I want something to smoke. And he pulls out a bag with 3 rocks of crack cocaine in it. And I'm looking at it like, that's not the smoke I was looking for.
But
I don't know when I'll have the opportunity to buy crack next. Yes. So I might as well stock up now in case I might need it later. I mean, sure. It's like you're in a thrift store and it's like, oh, I'm never going to find that radio again.
True,
I'm going to pick that up. So, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's way easier to find crack than I thought it was. But I was like, oh, well, I might as well just grab it. So
I might as well smoke some crack.
I didn't smoke it that night. I actually brought it home.
Wait until the morning.
No, it was weeks later. Mm-hmm. I brought it home and it was sitting in my drawer down here. Mm-hmm. And I thought one day, I was like, oh, I'm just going to smoke that crack and see what it's like.
Yeah.
And I sat down and I had a glass pipe. It had a little bit of DMT residue in it, mm-hmm. but I had pretty much, I mean, I mm-hmm. hit that thing mm-hmm. so many times, all the DMT residue was mm-hmm. gone. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only do that so many times yeah. before. It's just like, just a little aftertaste there. So I put the crack in and I smoked it and it didn't really do much. I was like, I smoked, and I was like, God, I smoked a lot. It didn't really do much.
Huh.
And I felt a little buzzy, and my lips and tongue were numb, and I went up and did some chores, and I was like, I'm not really feeling anything.
What a bummer.
Maybe I should go do more. So uh-huh. I went, and I really, really, you know, stoked up the bowl,
cooked
and I
was it.
Like, and I just went, and I just hit this white light space that was like more transcendent than anything that I had ever done on psychedelics, and I do that in quotes uh-huh. because I was so separated from reality.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I just was like suddenly in a bubble and everything slowed down and I just felt perfectly at peace.
Wow.
And I was like, I see why people like this now. This is really interesting. I wonder how long it lasts. And then suddenly my, you know, after like literally 2 or 3 minutes in the space, it's very much like DMT. It doesn't last very long. You only have that transcendent breakthrough space for a few minutes. And then once it starts to come down, you realize that your heart has been beating so fast, it's like a hum.
Wow.
And then as it starts to slow down, you get all of these weird palpitations that make you feel all fucked up, or at least I did.
Not fun anymore.
And I was like, oh man, that's enough of that. I'm not going to do that. But all day for the next 2 days, I still had another rock of crack left.
Mm-hmm.
I was walking around the house going, crack.
When that am crack I going to smoke that crack?
That crack's still down there. That crack's still there. What are you going to do with that crack? Remember that crack? That crack's there.
So.
And I was like, fucking shut up. And then back in my head, I'd be like, do-do-do-do-do. Here I am. I'm going to do some chores. Crack. Oh, God. Now I have work to do. Crack. And I was like, God, now I understand why people get addicted to this.
So on.
So I smoked the rest of it, and that was it.
Yeah.
Aww. I said, never going to do this again.
Did you break through
again? It wasn't as intense because I didn't smoke as much. I was like, maybe I could just modulate it and get
a little bit.
But it didn't work, and I didn't enjoy it. I felt like the enjoyable part of it was that like complete breakthrough into another space. And I was like, the come down was just not worth it for what it was. If I could find a way to just spend all day in that space,
oh my God,
that would be fun.
Yeah, if you figure that out, you should let me know.
So on this week's episode of
Super Crack,
on this week's episode of Dose Nations, James Kent advocates the crack experience.
Super Crack for everybody.
Hilla seeks it out for everyone.
Everyone should have fair access.
I think I'm just going to wear my sandals.
Transcendent crack space.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where I doubt no matter how many times I smoke crack again, I would ever hit that spot the same way I did the first time, because it's hard to do that. I mean, I know from previous drugs that I've done, you have a transcendent first time experience and you go chasing that every single time and it's never quite the same.
Well, that's a platitude in the crack community that they're always chasing the first high, right? I think that may be where it comes from.
That's a heroin community too. Yeah. It's the same. Yeah. So that's that story. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic story.
Sharing.